Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to start the afternoon panels. The procedure, as you know, is two panels. Panel number one, chaired by Sandy Gourlay, will begin in a moment, and then we're going to have between the two panels a meditation on the Book of Job designs with music by Stephen Nachmanovich. And then after that, 4:30, the party and exhibition, to all of which you're cordially invited. So I'm just going to let Sandy begin by introducing the afternoon panelists. Sandy, this is Professor Sandy Gourlay from the Rhode Island School of Design.
We have three papers more diverse than even the diversity we had this morning. And we're in a sort of accelerated mode here. So I'm afraid that it's sometimes going to seem like a cross between a game show and a scholarly conference. But the basic format is that people will sketch out abstracts of complex arguments that they've worked on for months and try to boil them down to a few minutes. And then at the end, we'll expand upon those issues that seem to be of most interest to the people in the audience. The first to speak is Professor Johnny Grant of the University of Iowa, Professor Emeritus of English, Songs for Thomas Butts, Visions of the Title Page, Earth's Answer, and Perhaps the Tiger.
Please, everyone, my tendency toward hoarseness and low voice may not carry back very far. So signal, if you would, if I'm not sounding off enough. Okay. In 1806, when Thomas Butts paid 6 guineas for Songs of Innocence and of Experience, copy E, along with an unspecified number of drawings, he received what Robert Ennis describes in his fine Huntington Library facsimile of edition of 2008 as a, quote, particularly unusual copy. To fill Butts's order, Blake made selections from his stock of unsold, previously printed impressions, mainly from 1794 and 1795. In shaping these heterogeneous materials into a finished, illuminated book, he strengthened the text and some design elements in ink and added color to most, if not all, the pages, while touching up minute features of many of the designs. He ignored other interesting details or covered them in watercolor, as if he no longer considered them essential to the effect that he wished to produce. Thank you. The title page alone, I won't have time for other pages, despite the title, as distinctively realized in the copy for Butts of 1806, occupies a unique place in the evolution of related visual motifs in Blake's production of songs from 1795 to 1826. Comparative examples from Blake's next printing or retouching of his work, Kirke 1818, in copies U, T2, and R, seem especially pertinent, even though in the 1818 versions, the dating of the title page is uncertain. Finally, representing Blake's later handling of these motifs, we'll look at copies Z and AA, produced in 1826. Of course, the 25 title pages for songs that Blake privately published over a span of 32 years were never seen together in one room, not even by Blake. So appreciation of the full spectrum of variations among his depictions of Adam and Eve and their divine human and animal companions requires that the ideal spectator, whom Blake summons in A Vision of the Last Judgment, to enter into these images in his imagination, approaching them in the fiery chariot of contemplative thought. And engage it. Nevertheless, among time-bound spectators, Blake had a better opportunity than most to see the, had a better opportunity than most to see the main figures in his copy of songs in relation to their appearances in other treatments of Adam and Eve by Blake that Butts was to acquire over the next 2 years. First, let's look at some contextualizing minutiae. Beside the first of in Butts' copy of songs is an open-beaked bird that can be recognized as an eagle with its hooked beak and distinctive shape of its upper wings. Note the resemblance to the indubitable eagles of Marriage of Heaven and Hell 15 and Milton 38:42. The mighty bird emits a cry as it soars above male and female nudes on rocks beside ocean. No, we're back still with the Milton, toward the G of songs. It's the only eagle to be found among Blake's 25 title pages, early or late. Now back to the close-up of the title page. decorating the initial S is a faint indication of what I call the exhorter on the S, the exhorter figure, together with a clearly delineated, slumped-over figure in some copies worked up as a scribe or reader. Next. In most earlier or later copies, the two miniature figures are distinctly seen on the initial S as a pair, as an example. And that'll pay another songs R. But in copy R, Blake kept by him from 1795 until he sold it to John Linnell in 1819. The exhorter has been transformed into a mere tendril and spout. You see what he is. Next, songs T, close up of the title page. In this composite copy, made of components datable circa 1818, the exhorter stands in the usual position on the initial S, but as a witness merely. Noah with a lowered right arm held in front, bent forward, looking down at the reader. Next, songs E, title page again, accompanied with songs U of 1818. Now compare the rendering of the exhorter and the bird in Butts's copy on the left with that in copy U at Princeton, produced in circa 1818 on the right. The one we have in the Norton critical edition. Did To be sure, the most important changes occur in Blake's treatment of the plight of Adam and Eve. In Butts's 1806 copy, placed on a spit of land, they are overcome in fire and despair, while in this 1818 version, with their faces visible, they exhibit resistance and defiance. Eve is speaking to us. To us. This alliteration persists in later copies through 1826. As his collection grew, Bartz had the opportunity to compare the expulsion on the title page of his Songs of 1806 with, next slide, and there it is, okay, with that great work of 1807, traditionally entitled The Fall of Man, which was probably intended as a companion to his A Vision of Last Judgment, Butts 639, of the previous year. I propose instead to call this work Prospects of Divine Humanity, as I argue at length in a book, William Blake, Severe Contentions, Burning Fire of Thought, soon to be published. In 1876, this picture was exhibited as The Redemption, which at least is more fitting than the title The Fall of Man. As you can see, the fall has already taken place in the background. I have to look up the steps. And after the fall, Adam and Eve have descended the stairway behind them, away from Eden. Okay, central figures. Now we've got them there. Now the Savior assumes a place of guidance between them. As hand in hand, the central figures move as a threesome, with Jesus looking up to the guidance of the dove. Adam looking over to him, and Eve looking down her side at the instance of primal predation on the part of the tiger, that is. Far left as you see it. That was the second person of the Trinity joining the first people as divine humanity, supervised their departure from Eden, an entirely new idea. Now, two sets of expulsion scenes. Both prospects of divine humanity for Butts and the Paradise Lost design for Joseph Thomas, with the expulsion scene on the left, were signed and dated 1807. No receipts or other evidence establishes which came first. Presumably, the commission for Reverend Thomas stimulated Blake's rethinking of the departure from paradise in prospects and inspired him to replace Milton's humane archangel with the dove-led savior as the first people's ultimate guide. A year later, reprising the Paradise Lost designs for Butts in an expulsion scene on the right, Blake weaves the gestural motifs from Eve's side of the prospect.
Speak a little louder, prospects. Jack. A little louder.
Okay. With a gesture of consternation or apprehension, both Adam and Eve look down at the serpent, not back at their flame. Though not yet imbued with the spirit of resistance of their 1818 counterparts, on the title page of Songs, copy U, they appear to have overcome their defeat and despair of the 1806 couple who hide their faces beneath the expulsive fires of Butts's Songs, copy E. And Now I'm going to shift gears if there is time for it. This being the year of the tiger, I shall bid him farewell, though he didn't leave Eden with the first three when Eve first laid eyes upon him in primal predation. Songs copy E, the tiger. Before the recent renovation. When the tiger, songs 42, seen here in Butz's copy called plate 40, tiger sets out on his nearer modern departure from beneath the tallest dead tree at the edge of the forests of the night. He produces consternation in the tree spirit as Wright, who has witnessed his arrival. No, I'm looking for a tiger again. Okay, that'll do, I think. Song Z, the tiger. Time. Okay. Copy Z, indeed, the tree witness has his eyes shut. Can you see it up there at the beginning of the text? Remember, you only got half a face here. The tree is split down the middle. And the face up there has the eyes shut. And very unusual, though the witness is always there, for this version of the tiger. It's without a period at the end of the title, in case anybody noticed. And is leaving with its mouth agape. Did the tree witness foresee the modern folly of discoursing about Blake's tiger as a toy? I'm likely to leave it at that point since I've run out of time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Next, we have Dennis Reed. Is professor of English at Denison University. He has just finished a book on Blake's perhaps not nemesis, but stimulator, Chromek, and is giving us a piece of his mind on that, perhaps another small piece.
Sandy makes it sound like a sexual implement that Chromek might have been. We're going to have a drawing of Chromek. There he is. This is by John Flaxman in a notebook, which he used early in the 19th century. Chromek's somewhere around 32 in this side view. It's almost like a mugshot. Some would say that's appropriate. The notebook is in the Fitzwilliam Museum, Cambridge now. When Alexander Gilchrist's monumental biography of William Blake was first published in 1863, Thomas Hartley Chromek was confronted with startling accusations about his father. Gilchrist portrayed Robert Hartley Chromek as a second-rate engraver who turned to speculating on the talents of others. Gilchrist accused him specifically of stealing Blake's copyright to the grave designs and of outmaneuvering Blake by commissioning a painting and engraving of the Canterbury Pilgrims after Blake had begun his own. Chromek, Gilchrist wrote, made much from the venture, Blake virtually nothing from his. Gilchrist also asserted that Chromek had deprived Robert Burns's widow of payment after collecting and publishing his manuscripts, and he repeated Peter Cunningham's charge that Chromek stole from Sir Walter Scott a Ben Jonson letter to Drummond of Hawthornden. His catalog of adjectives for Chromek include slippery, unscrupulous, wily, treacherous, shifty, and predacious. In short, Gilchrist described Cromick as an unprincipled exploiter whose only interest was personal gain at the cost of others, in particular, Blake. Gilchrist's characterization of Cromick begins with what Blake had written privately about him in his notebook. His scurrilous verses and aphorisms scattered in his notebook form the story. After he had entered into an agreement with Cromick in good faith, Cromick had acted first dishonestly, then maliciously toward him. Gilchrist unquestioningly accepts this story, painting Cromick as the villain and Blake as the victim in their several disputes. In this stance, Gilchrist was following the traditional path of biographer as hagiographer. Anything that made Blake seem more admirable or sympathetic was useful. Investing Blake's adversaries with the opposite qualities intensified Blake's saintliness. Gilchrist's interest in Cromick, therefore, was limited to advancing the portrayal of Blake as the misunderstood, exploited, ridiculed, and neglected romantic artist. Thomas Hartley Cromick naturally took offense at Gilchrist's sullying of his father's reputation, but he was not in a good position to dispute it. Since he was only 3 years old in 1812 when his father died, he knew his father almost entirely through the recollections of his mother, who had died in 1848, and other family members. These recollections, not surprisingly, stood at odds with Gilchrist's version. Cromick had always understood that his father had been a hard-working engraver, a friend and respected associate among artists, writers, and publishers, and a successful editor and literary impresario. He had been given to believe that his father would have made a more lasting mark in British letters and the arts had he not been struck down at the height of his career by consumption, dying at 42. Thomas Hartley Cromick himself had become an accomplished watercolorist, partly to fulfill his father's artistic legacy. Early in his life at Wakefield, he had shown a talent for drawing. As a child, he studied briefly in London with the engraver James Hopwood, then returned to Wakefield, where he received instruction from the portrait painter James Hunter. In 1826, he moved to Leeds to study with James Rhodes. Seems to have only teachers named James as a requirement of some kind. In 1830, he traveled, that's a joke. He traveled to Florence and Rome, and in subsequent years, he visited sites of ancient ruins in Italy and Greece, which he rendered in drawings and paintings. While residing in Florence in 1837, he taught drawing to the young Edward Lear. He settled in Rome, but was forced to return to England in 1849 by the Garibaldian Civil War. In 1850, he was elected an associate of the New Society of Painters and Watercolors. He moved to Wakefield in 1851, remaining there for the duration of his life, dying in 1873. Thomas Cromick was encouraged by others to answer Gilchrist's charges. Among them was the artist William Buick, I practiced that too. William Buick, that's the right way, isn't it? Son of the celebrated wood engraver Thomas Buick. He wrote Cromick on February 12th, 1864, "I sincerely sympathize with you in your anxiety and vexation regarding the aspersions thrown out in the life of Blake. Surely serious untruths, when published to the world, ought to be contradicted. The public ought to be set right if you are in a position to do so without much trouble to yourself." 6 days later, Buick included in another letter to Cromick his recollection of an important informant in Gilchrist's biography, John Thomas Nollekens Smith. Buick writes, "I remember him well. He was a notorious gossip, and I knew ladies who used to go to the print room in the British Museum, where he was employed, to be amused by his endless and amusing tattle. He was a great retailer of anecdote and scandal, dealt largely in innuendo, and had a keen relish for any story of doubtful propriety." Other contemporaries of Cromick's father disputed Gilchrist's characterization. In a published review of Gilchrist's biography, William M. Tart wrote that Gilchrist greatly wrongs Cromick. Tart added, "We met Cromick in 1808 as the guest of Mr. Roscoe at Allerton, and knew him afterwards. And we do not believe him to have been the mercenary in literature or art that he is here described. In his dealings both with Blake and Studdard, he gave them what they required for the works he purchased. He faithfully fulfilled his engagements, and if he knew better than they did how to attract the attention of the public, he had a right to use such knowledge for his own advantage. It was only in this way that he made more by their works than they could have made themselves. That's the end of his quote. Cromick wrote to others from his home in Wakefield asking for recollections about his father, and he traveled to London to interview several of them. As a result, he was able to enlarge the manuscript Memorials of the Life of R.H. Cromick with the unpublished correspondence and other papers relative to his professional and literary career, which he had written about 6 months before Gilchrist's biography had been published. While this copy of Memorials has not survived, two later versions have, one dated December 23, 1864, and the other dated 27 July, 1865. Cromick also compiled a volume titled Recollections of Conversations with Mr. John Pye, dated May 1863, and still another volume dated December 1863, he reproduced extracts from Gilchrist's biography on the left-hand page and responded to them on the facing page. These volumes express Cromick's consternation over the abuse of his father's reputation, as well as the neglect or misuse of documents about his father that he had provided to various people over the years. Two instances of his providing information to others about his father stand out. Cromick reports that in 1833, during a brief stay in London, he lent to Alan Cunningham his copy of R.H. Cromick's vituperative letter of May 1807 to Blake, in which he refuses to buy from Blake his dedicatory design to the grave for 20 guineas. Very famous letter. Cunningham, Cromick states, never returned this unique document, instead passing it on to his son, Peter, who published it in the Gentleman's Magazine of February 1852, with no acknowledgement of its source. Gilchrist included the letter in its entirety in his biography, again, without indicating its source. Cromick ruefully writes, "The last person in whose hands I placed that letter was Alan Cunningham, and I have never seen it since." The second instance occurred after the publication of the biography of Thomas Studdard in 1852 by Studdard's daughter-in-law, Anne Eliza Bray. Cromick states that on October 8, 1854, he wrote to Bray correcting misinformation about Studdard's painting of the Canterbury Pilgrims. He previously had provided her with information that she had included in Reminiscences of Studdard, published in Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine in June 1836, with the acknowledgement, quote, "the account of the Canterbury Pilgrims given to me by Mr. Cromick." So she does acknowledge him. Bray forwarded Cromick's corrections to Gilchrist, who included them in his biography of Blake, but neglected to identify their original source. Cromick expostulates, "These facts were not communicated to anyone but Mrs. Bray, nor could they be known to anyone else, inasmuch as my father's memorandum book has never been out of my possession. The other sources, or rather source, to which Gilchrist alludes is myself and no one else. For Mrs. Bray, who must have given him the information directly or indirectly, had most assuredly received it from me. Why, therefore, should all acknowledgement of valuable information be denied to me and my name never once mentioned?" Cromick's effort to answer Gilchrist's assertions, however, came to little effect. His memorials, along with the papers and prints his father had left, remained with his heirs after his death in 1873. Over the years, occasional mention in print would be made of this cache. In his edition of Burns's works, W. Scott Douglas cites the owner of the original manuscript of Elegy on Willie Nichols Mare, the Burns poem, as Mrs. Mary Warrington, the granddaughter of R.H. Cromick. this is the daughter of Thomas Cromack, who had handwritten his memorials. She handwrote his memorials in other volumes because he had severe arthritis. She had married John Warrington in 1875. In the November 4th, 1882 Spectator, John Bell reports that there are papers in existence, now before me, belonging to the representatives of the late T.H. Cromack, which throw much light upon his father's transactions, and I need hardly point out that they give a most emphatic contradiction to the statements advanced in such a vindictive spirit by Cromack, by Blake's biographers. The representatives are not identified by Bell, but they probably are Thomas Cromack's daughters, Mary, Clorinda, and Anastasia, as well as their husbands, the husbands of Mary and Clorinda. In 1886, Samuel Richardson stated in his note to a plate engraved by Cromack, by Robert Cromack, Blake's accusations, however, were refuted by Cromack's son, indicating that Thomas Cromack's rebuttal had registered to some degree. And in the September 1917 Bookman of London, Davison Cook reports on stumbling over Douglas's reference and subsequently visiting Austin Warrington, son of Mary Warrington, she died in 1907, who very kindly favored me with the loan of memorials. In 1867, Cromack gave 119 engravings executed by his father, along with a drawing by Howard, another by Stoddard, and a unique print by Blake. Now we're ready for the other one. The other. It is up there?
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't paying attention. Okay, that's the unique print by Blake. All of that was given to the British Museum print room. We know it's a Blake print thanks to the research of G.E. Bentley Jr., who identified the paper as from designs to a series of ballads, and that was enlarged. The cache of known Blake drawings on that paper was enlarged by in an article by Karen Mulholland. And you recognize it as the frontispiece to Malkin's A Father's Memoirs of His Child. So there's an interesting story, which you'll I'll save for another time. Also, the University of Edinburgh Library has a collection of 167 letters addressed to Thomas Cromack. Other documents and pieces of information relating to father and son are in various public and private collections in the United Kingdom and the United States. But the most important documents relating to Cromack's career now are in the Princeton University Library. The collection, comprising 9 bound volumes of papers relating to the careers of the two Cromacks, were sold at Sotheby's of London on July 17, 2008, by the heirs of the Warrington family to the antiquarian booksellers John Hart and Chris Johnson. Princeton purchased the lot from them in March 2009. Among the volumes are Memorials, Recollections of Conversations with Mr. John Pye, and the critical commentary on Gilchrist's biography of Blake. In my book, which is titled R.H. Cromack, Engraver, Editor, Entrepreneur, to be published next February by Aldgate, I attempt to give Cromack his full due. Please pardon the shameless self-promotion. Certainly, Cromack was no exemplar of altruism, but he hardly lived in an age of altruism. He was an ambitious and determined individual who recognized entrepreneurial opportunities in a developing capitalistic marketplace. In this endeavor, he was following pioneer businessmen of the 18th century who, in J.H. Plum's words, realizing that there was a market in culture, began quite deliberately to exploit it and to pursue innovation and sophistication in order to reap the profits that were there. Thank you.
Next, we have Gary Leonard, who teaches in cinema studies and English here at the University of Toronto. Without contraries is no progression. Did Blake invent modernist cinema? And there's a handout, I guess, headed your way.
I didn't, despite being in cinema, I didn't dare rely on technology for a 10-minute talk. So I've simply sent around a montage of images, which will also be appropriate because I'm going to be referring to montage as one of several cinema techniques. We heard from Professor Viscomri earlier that maybe it's possible to travel back to 1790 and find some more Blake manuscripts. I'm actually going the other way and asking, and I'll ask this provocatively and baldly in the interest of time, were it possible would William Blake have been a director? And my question stems partly from my sense that how hard Blake worked to, if you will, make his images move. In addition, as an engraver, which was certainly considered a secondary art form to oil paint, you have an odd parallel with cinema, and we also heard about this from Professor Viscomri as well, in that you have to bow to economic realities to a perhaps unprecedented degree. The history of cinema is rife with famous anecdotes of shortcuts that have been taken because budgets have run out. Orson Welles probably owns most of these anecdotes. But there is this common practice where you strive to recreate a vision that's in your mind with the economic and material realities that are at your fingertips. And the gap is often invention. The gap between the two, rather than becoming a shortcoming, actually becomes, to borrow a Blakean metaphor, but seems to become a cauldron or an anvil upon which you strike. So I also, although we have no record that Blake ever made a film, that, you know, and again, there's plenty of archives we haven't got to the bottom of. But there's something that I argue as proto-cinematic in a book of mine that's coming out, since we're mentioning those, called Six Ways of Looking at Modernity, Hollywood Genres and the Production of the Modern Subject. And I argue very much for the idea that how we see predates the literal capacity to produce cinema by quite a few years. Now, many cinema scholars will go to 1850, 1860, 1870 to begin to argue for a way of seeing that would permit cinema itself to take shape and take form. I have no problem bringing it back to Blake. It's remarkable when I go over his poetry how often he talks about what we in visual culture now would call scopic regimes, for instance, or the structure of vision, or seeing as a social act. There's a remarkable amount of cogent theory, and I'll just mention many of these lines you may know, but let me put them together. Let me juxtapose them in a kind of montage. As a man is, so he sees. As the eye is formed, such are its powers. The eye altering alters all. Even those two clearly bring us right to vision as something structured, something formed, and something that has a kind of simultaneous effect on the formation of the human sensibility. All of this is becoming almost commonplace in visual culture approaches to cinema and the interaction of spectator to image on the screen. I break it down into three sections with Blake. Blake's comments on contraries as progression, which is almost synonymous with Eisenstein's definition of montage as the collision of two images producing a third, which is not innate in either of the other two images. Montage is fascinated with the meaning that is created in the gaps, something that Blake seems rather comfortable with. Even when John was looking at the pictures of Adam and Eve earlier, he mentioned that you can see that the fall has already taken place, and then he directed your eye by saying, you have to look up the steps. Now, in cinema, we would call that deep focus, where an image is deliberately shot so wide and with such deep focus that your eye is not overly directed. And this is certainly an experience I have standing in front of a Blake painting, is you you can stand there for 4 or 5 minutes, and it takes a while for the picture to unfold. It seems to participate in duration in a way that very little art does. In other words, you cannot take in a Blake painting at a glance. You can't, an engraving, you can't. You stand before it and you start to notice, and then something else, and it takes you into the picture. Orson Welles most famously perfected this in Citizen Kane, and he was in fact reacting a little bit against montage, which he thought potentially was over-directed. So contraries as progression is one aspect of Blake that I see as proto-cinematic. The other is Blake's insistence that space and time can be either collapsed or elongated at will, which is practically a prediction of the effect of editing. Editing is, whatever else it is a manipulation of space and time, literally. I can't imagine Blake wouldn't have been interested in that. So when I look at a Blake painting and I see all of the words that seem to entwine themselves, many see text and image. I see voiceover. I see film noir. I see this. Isn't this? Aren't these words in your head while you look? They're not. They're not to be read and then picture and then read. They are intertwined to the degree where you almost can imagine someone going down that poorly lit, wet street at night saying, you know, where did that dame come from? Or words to that effect, that extraordinary capacity of cinema to generate third terms through juxtaposition of the aural and the visual. Montage is... you know these as well, but let me put this in this context. This is Blake. The only God worth worshiping is a God, though in his essence timeless, continually enters and redeems time. Eternity is in love with the productions of time. Is, to me, again, has a proto-cinematic capacity to it. You have to construct a movie, but you can make the timely and the timeless go back and forth. Now, if you receive the handout, Kubrick's 2001 is the offering I have, but I'm really talking about cinema in general. One of the most famous manipulations of space and time is when an ape who, in a very Lowe's-like manner, has been hammering away at some bones, tosses the bone skyward, and as it achieves the apogee of its curve, it turns into a spaceship circling the moon. This is arguably the most famous jump cut in cinema history because it compresses 4 million years into a flash. Now, Blake did that all the time. In fact, not only did he do it all the time, he kept urging us to do it, to see infinity in an hour, to see the world in a grain of sand. So Blake is constantly arguing that we need to fiercely compress and savagely explode space and time, something that a skilled editor in cinema has made enormous use of. I won't have time to elaborate on this, but cinema is often also understood as something that arose simultaneously with what we now call modernity, with the modern city, industrialization. But it's easy for modernists to forget, I don't think the Romantics forget this at all, that industrialization didn't start in 1890, and that arguably, and I'm not sure how to prove this one way or the other, but Blake's shock at the Satanic Mills in London and back before no one knew anything about pollution and so on may well have been more shocking than the more famous stories of Victorian cities in the 1880s. So we are dealing with a writer who both, a writer and a painter, engraver, who registered in his poems and his images the shock of the modern. It often strikes me that Blake's engravings are done in such a way, and I think many of you are more expert at this than me, but to produce an impression of explosion, of force generating outward. Walter Benjamin rather famously described cinema as the dynamite of a tenth of a second. And Benjamin argued that what cinema could do, and I think Blake is already attempting this, is it could explode normal temporal spatial hierarchical hegemonic perceptions, the other key Blakean term, perception, so that it could create what Benjamin called an optical unconscious. In other words, it would leave us with the uneasy, not to be dismissed notion that reality also consists of more than we can see. Again, a fairly familiar concept, I think, to those who have studied Blake in depth. This is really, you know, just to begin discussion of whatever sort we might like to have after this. I'll close with certainly one of my favorite Blake quotes, but one that arguably for me also is that nowhere to be located third impression that cinema art is always attempting to find. There is a moment in each day that Satan cannot find, nor can his watch fiends find it. And when it once is found, it renovates every moment of the day, if rightly placed. Thank you.
Yes, Dennis, during the research for your book, could you possibly expand upon Flaxman's relationship with Cromack?
Well, Flaxman, I'm pretty sure, is the person who put Cromack and Blake together. Flaxman started with Cromack. Well, Mr. Bentley might be able to help me on that, but anyhow, Flaxman was close to Cromack, very much an ally, very much a supporter, and wrote to Haley, for instance, trying to get a couple of engraving commissions that way. This is right at the beginning of the 19th century. And in that notebook picture that I produced, there's also a drawing of Blake, as well as a lot of other people they were hanging out with. So he was very helpful during that first decade of the 19th century for Cromack. And I'm pretty sure that he's the one who was able to start them off, first with the Malkin little project, and then with the grave designs, with all of that.
I'd like to ask Professor Leonard a question. Mm-hmm. Have you worked also with Blake's relationship to the Book of Revelation? Because as you were speaking, I was thinking, these things that you're saying, also, I mean, that's a montage.
Yes.
In which time and space can be conflated and things can morph into one another. Have you included that in your discussion?
Well, I'm in early days as far as proving that Blake invented cinema. and certainly with the four Zoas, I've already tried to look at, you know, the fact that you have this explosion of the four and all of that entails, and then the various tensions of whether or not they can realign themselves. One claim I've made about the jump cut is, and I'm still trying to figure out how much Kubrick may have known about Blake on a separate note, is it's remarkable how fast we go from Los to Horizon in a single cut. We go from the ape hammering, throwing the bone up with pure exultation, sheer joy, if you look at the scene of that ape. And once the bone has become the spaceship, there isn't another drop of emotion in that movie. It seems like Horizon took over and we went from the hammer to the compass, or from the ape to Hal, the computer. And so these kind of, even those kind of tensions between reason and, you know, I will not reason and compare, my business is to create, is implicit, in, especially in Revelations and in the Zoas.
Thanks.
Yes.
Professor Leonard, as I heard you speaking about the multiple, almost technical, or techniques Blake uses in his paintings and his poetry, in effect, I come at this from a Germanistic background, and I wondered how much you see an affiliation between Blake and maybe German Expressionism, and in theater and in the burgeoning or growing film industry of the 19-teens and early 20s. Mm-hmm. I see connections there, and they must have obviously been aware of Blake, no doubt.
I think that if I had to pick a movement, I would certainly go to Expressionism. I would go even more specifically to the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is the standard in many ways. But the way, the famous distorted windows, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, we would see eternity we'd see time for what it is, infinite. There's a sense that the distorted world around the reduced characters in Caligari, that strikes me as very Blakean, where you have, if you will, the illustration. If you think of the set as illustration, and if you think of the characters acting out as text, you have a Blake illustrated manuscript where the illustrations are often arguing with the various characters in the text. Yes, I think that's absolutely true.
Thank you. Do you want to take a brief break? Oh, we've got a question.
This is for Professor Leonard. I'm very interested by your idea of the optical unconscious, which I definitely think is inherent in Blake's work, and I think he even draws our attention to this, for example, in Visions of the Daughters of Albion, where he says...
Would you speak louder, please?
I'm really interested in the idea of the optical unconscious, and I think that Blake is definitely drawing the reader's attention to this aspect in his work and sort of the interpretation of symbols. When, for example, in the Visions of the Daughters of Albion, he says the eye sees the heart knows. Mm. I'm just wondering, do you think that he's trying explicitly to draw the reader's attention to this unconscious? It's a didactic purpose. He wants us to examine this, or do you think he's just...
I think it's when you read Henri Bergson, who writes a lot about duration, you also seem to have some elaborate formalizing of what Blake again has already intuited, and that is that time is elastic. It's particularly in its experiential modality. So I mean, every schoolboy knows this, that in biology class the clock slows down, and at recess, where did the time go? I mean, it's a common experience, but Blake wants to do more than that. He doesn't just want to note it. It strikes me that Blake is arguing that we must elongate time, and this goes along with Walter Benjamin, that by elongating time, we'll discover more and more the degree to which it has been constructed, and how it can be undermined and seen past, how you can cleanse those doors of perception.
More questions. We'll take a break until 3:00 and reconvene. Just come back a few minutes early and we can get back on schedule.